everybody. So we felt like we sort of had to wrap up quickly the other day, and we had a lot more ground to cover. And we're already here in Florida, and we've got a few days. So Doc was gracious enough to share some more of his time with me for us to do a part two. And I have to also thank my friend Sean Klein with Homebase Management, which is his short-term rental company, for finding us an excellent space to do this right here on at 419 East Atlantic in Delray. And this is actually not an ad, but I am going to put a link to the space in the description. If anyone, this is a functional Airbnb, but it's also a great co-working space. And Sean really, really helped us out at the last minute to get us in here. So we were finishing up yesterday, Doc. We were talking about the potential anti-aging benefits of touring specifically. And, you know, I was really struck by a couple things about that conversation from you. You know, you mentioned the study that came out, you said, I think it was June 8th, right? And you immediately started to implement this. And you know, there's sort of an online community around this anti-aging conversation now more than there used to be. So when things like this happen, they do make headlines. People start, you know, making YouTube videos about them to sort of summarize them to people. But you do something a little different, which I think is unique, which you look at it and say, now why would that work that way? And you dug a little bit deeper into some other literature and dug into, you know, how its impact on and GABA and how it declines as we age. And you started using, you got a little bit deeper on its impact on anatomy. And were you saying it was a precursor to melatonin?
No, it actually stimulates melatonin production from the pineal gland.
So it stimulates melatonin production from the pineal gland, right. And you even talked about specific anatomical structures in the brain where endogenous production of melatonin has more of an impact, right? And I think the word that you used, and I had the most ridiculous grin on my face whenever you said the words suprachiasmatic nucleus, right?
Correct.
And you know, I mentioned to you in that conversation some of these prominent anti-aging names that are figures like Andrew Huberman and David Sinclair and Walter Longo. And maybe they're not all entirely anti-aging guys. Maybe they're just commentators about human performance more broadly and lifestyle, right? And no disrespect to any of those people. You know, I know that those people work at institutions with deep pockets where they have the resources and latitude to perform studies that have real impact, like Walter Longo's fasting study and the fact that Andrew Huberman is a neuroscientist at Stanford University. And that's not you, right? You run an independent practice. But I want to clarify for everyone listening a little bit more about what I was getting at with that is, you know, fundamentally what these people are, specifically Huberman, is someone who is fundamentally credible in terms of their credentials and the way that they're able to communicate their ideas, the way they're able to take different data points, combine them and synthesize them into practical steps that people can take and present that in a way that is accessible for people, but is also still has a great amount of depth. And to me, you know, you demonstrated just in your discussion about taurine that this is very much you. And this is really what I want to emphasize. I know over the past 10, 15 years, you have built a lot of depth as a cancer doctor, and you have the story about your mom, and you even helped my mom with cancer. But I really see you potentially in the same category as some of these other guys. I really do. We were digging through your CV and we spent a good 20, 30 minutes talking about cancer. What I want to do today is I want to flesh out more of these human performance, general health conversations. And actually, I would also like to dig a little bit deeper into, you know, this human story of what I've went through recently and how you've helped me in the past couple of years, and what I've learned through that process. Just because this is a drum that I just want to keep beating, and it's a message that I think a lot of people and a lot of doctors need to hear, at the risk of me being very vulnerable publicly. So we left off our discussion with taurine, and we touched a little bit on the role of GlyNAc specifically, which is the combination of glycine and N-acetylcysteine. And you were talking about how these things are the precursors to the body's most powerful endogenous antioxidant. So, you know, the study that I mentioned that I'm the most familiar with is the impact that this has on insulin sensitivity. And actually, I'm evidence of that. I don't know if you remember, but you and I did some extensive lab work on me back in February. And yes, I was running. Yes, I was on a diet. But I had also been on GlyNAc for a couple months. And you may remember my insulin level. You know, if there is a if there's a spectrum that demonstrates a person's insulin sensitivity, mine was at the very bottom of the spectrum where a child's might be. And so I'm sort of living proof of that, but it seems like there's more to this story than just the impact on insulin sensitivity.
Without question, yeah. So you're specifically talking about glycine and N-acetylcysteine, mm-hmm. as opposed to taurine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, glycine and N-acetylcysteine combination is very interesting. And as I mentioned earlier, there were a couple of studies that were done at Baylor, at Baylor College of Medicine. And the interesting thing that we mentioned is the combination of glycine and N-acetylcysteine are two of the three substances that are necessary to produce glutathione. But as I want to mention, there have been studies showing that too much of anything is not good. There's a sweet spot. So, for example, there was a study done quite a while ago in mice where they gave the mice very large amounts of antioxidants, expecting to see the mice live longer, and they saw the converse. They actually lived shorter. And they wanted to obviously figure out what happened, and they found a decrease in the endogenous production of antioxidants from the mitochondria in response to giving so many antioxidants. And where is the bulk of the oxidative stress occurring? It's occurring at the mitochondria, the level of the mitochondria. So the point is that there is a sweet spot for everything. Too little of something is no good, too much of something is no good. So the concept by the investigators at Baylor was very interesting. Instead of just giving large amounts of glutathione, they gave the cells the opportunity to decide whether they need glutathione by giving them two of the three substances that are the precursor to forming glutathione. They gave them glycine and N-acetylcysteine, large amounts. In the human study, it was 100 milligrams per kilogram. And so they gave the cells the opportunity to say, well, if I need glutathione, I've got two of the three substances to make it now. And if I don't, I can just take the cysteine component and make other proteins. And the remarkable findings in the study was many of the hallmarks of aging were reversed. So they saw less gene mutations. They saw improved mitochondrial function. They saw less senescent cells. They found the individuals had better mitochondrial function as manifested by improved endurance, physical endurance, improved strength, improved speed of gait. So it really, and we can talk about many other hallmarks of aging. Yeah.
So specifically, you mentioned gait. This is sort of ringing a bell for me. I know that actually one of the hallmarks of aging that we've learned to look to is the way a person's balance deteriorates over time and how that does impact their gait. And I do remember specifically something about the way GlyNAC impacts, or had an impact on the elderly subjects' gait. It actually improved.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely.
So anyway, so continue. Sorry.
So yeah, I want to point out is that with really every hallmark of aging that we consider hallmarks of aging that they studied were reversed by giving these doses of glycine and N-acetylcysteine. And I'll share with the public that since these articles came out, I am taking, it's a lot of stuff to take, but I take 100 milligrams per kilogram of glycine and N-acetylcysteine every day. I don't miss a dose. And I also, you know, we talked about taurine earlier, but I take my taurine with it as well. I will comment, you know, people have asked me, since I've been taking 100 milligrams per kilogram of glycine and N-acetylcysteine, have I noticed anything? And I'm going to be honest, I personally have not. But, you know, keep in mind that, you know, I want the public to realize that I've been calorie restricting for quite some time. I eat what I consider a very healthy diet, which is mostly plant-based and fish. And of course, it's a low glycemic diet because I'm thriving on fruits and vegetables and legumes and nuts and seeds. And so, and I exercise daily. So I'm really doing everything as best I can. And I haven't seen that adding glycine and N-acetylcysteine has personally made me feel better. Now, I will comment quickly again on taurine. When I did take the maximum amount of taurine that humans have consistently taken, 10 grams a day, that within a week, I saw a difference. And the biggest difference that I saw with that was energy level improved, and the fatigue that I typically feel at the end of working 12 to 14 hours, that was greatly mitigated.
Wow.
And I did see that.
So speaking of glycine, and actually before we do that, I want to touch on something else and ask you a question. Do you think that the decrease, you said there was a decrease in endogenous production of glutathione in the rats in response to glutathione supplementation directly as opposed to the precursors?
Well, so in the study I was referring to, it was an old mouse study, and they gave them various antioxidants.
Oh,
but they gave them large amounts of antioxidants, I mean, much higher than what they would normally be exposed to. And that was not a good thing. And again, that's why I talk about, you know, there's redox, there's oxidation reduction reactions that they need to be in appropriate balances. And if you do too much of one side or the other, you're going to offset that balance. And that's what they discovered in the mouse study.
Do you think that has more to do with somehow the mouse's systems directly responding to the presence of those particular chemicals, or do you think it's more of a dynamic response to less inflammatory signaling as a result of higher antioxidant levels?
Well, yeah, so what do I think? I think there is an appropriate amount of inflammatory signaling. There's got to be an appropriate amount. You don't want to turn off inflammation completely because you're not going to be able to handle pathogens. You need inflammation.
Right.
So again, every single process that goes on in the body, and we understand so little, but every single process has to have a homeostatic set point, right? And what we like to do often is go past that set point. We like to treat with extremes. And what we find out is when we go past those extremes, like we did in the mouse study, that's not optimal for the organism. Every organism has their best set point. And, you know, what happens with the aging process is the ability to keep homeostasis is lost. And that's what we talked about taurine, for example. By the time an individual is about 65 years of age, their stores of taurine have dropped by about 80%. And of course, we do know that similarly with glutathione, our glutathione stores greatly drop. Our antioxidant capacities greatly drop. But again, there is a sweet spot for everything. And we are doing our best to find out where those sweet spots are.
One question that I always have about any of these anti-aging conversations where someone mentions that a given hormone level tends to drop, a given nutrient level or any compound tends to drop with age is there a longevity benefit to the fact that they drop? Or is it simply downstream from David Sinclair's idea, just that as our DNA replicates, it degrades over time, and is it a distortion or is it a feature?
That's an excellent point that you're bringing up, and I'm going to say all of the above. So it's interesting, let me just give an example. IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. So insulin-like growth factor 1 is produced by the liver in response to growth hormone. IGF-1 is one of the substances that activates mTOR. So everybody out there in the anti-aging world knows that, well, if we can slow down or turn off the activation of mTOR, we can live longer. We've seen that in the animal studies. On the other hand, well, we need IGF-1 for adequate muscle mass. You tell a bodybuilder that we want you to live long, so we're going to shut down your mTOR activation. And as a matter of fact, we know that there are groups of individuals who have mutations in their IGF-1 receptors, and they're all really small. And they live a really long time, and they're really healthy. But again, you know, so we have to balance quality of life with quantity of life. That's what we want to do as humans. But looking at your IGF-1, your IGF-1 typically falls as we age. And to answer your question, I think that is a protective mechanism. Now, on the other hand, if we could, let's say, for example, with David Sinclair's work, you know, he's trying to fix the transcriptome by replacing the loss of epigenetic information. Now, maybe if we were able to do that, then it's okay to get the IGF-1 back up, right? Because we're not making all these DNA errors. So, but what I'm getting at is many of the things that happen now, the natural fall of IGF-1, that's one example. TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone. Thyroid-stimulating hormone tends to rise as we age. That may be a protective effect as well. So what we're talking about, when the thyroid-stimulating hormone elevates, we're calling that hypothyroidism. And we say, well, no, that's not good, because we want to put your thyroid back to where you were 25. But what we see in the elderly population, if you do that, if you put their thyroid hormone back to where they were when they were very young, they start absorbing bone and their bone densities get worse. So what I'm getting at, I want to summarize so the viewers understand what I'm getting at. Many of the substances that change or fall with aging, I think that is an adaptation of our bodies to deal with our aging milieu to protect us. Now, so when we take just one substance like IGF-1 and say, I'm not going to fix anything else, I'm just going to give that back to you, there's going to be downstream consequences mm-hmm. of that. Now, we're not there yet. But if we can combine, you know, great hypotheses like what David Sinclair has and fix the problem all the way upstream. And let me explain what I mean by all the way upstream. So we talked about many of the hallmarks of aging. We have mitochondrial dysfunction. Okay, we have loss of antioxidants. We have senescent cells. So what is the very upstream cause of all these problems? Well, we're not sure. And there are scientists like David Sinclair that are trying to figure that out. But what I'm getting at is, if we can fix the problem all the way upstream that causes all these downstream effects, maybe then it's okay to say, I'm going to give you more testosterone, and I'm going to give you more IGF-1, and I'm going to put your thyroid back to where it was, and it'll be safe. But right now, until we figure that out, until we go right to that very first upstream signaling problem, we have to be very careful when we replace some of the substances that have decreased.
So I think we do also have to consider all of this, not just in the context of the dynamics of our human system, but also the dynamics of us humans in our modern environment. And where I'm going with that is this, one of the hallmarks of aging, you mentioned, gait, one of the big ones is a loss of muscle mass over sure. time. And I think the other thing that you see is much of what kills people is metabolic disease. Particularly in this country.
Absolutely.
I think there's enough out there that we can say that, in some sense, heart disease is a metabolic disease. Type 2 diabetes is very common. Type 2 diabetes is a metabolic disease. And there's arguments that, many other chronic diseases that maybe are not necessarily commonly tied to metabolism might also have a metabolic disease component like we talked about yesterday with Alzheimer's. So, that being the case, I would think that this loss of muscle mass is one of those things that contributes to our decline in metabolic function, simply because our muscles enhance our metabolism, and then also when we use those muscles, they secrete beneficial hormones, right? And so you can say, maybe it's a protective benefit to decrease IGF-1. Maybe our testosterone drops as we age, which has a longevity benefit, right? But I think there is still a trade-off, which is there's this loss in muscle mass, and with our diet, we maybe end up with metabolic disease faster. So it's difficult for me to know where to land on some of this stuff, because I absolutely hear what you're saying, but there's also, I think, an argument to be made, maybe there's a trade-off, but maybe it's good to keep some of this stuff going.
Exactly what you're saying to me is what I said before. There's a sweet spot for everything.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. Look, if your testosterone is so low and your IGF-1 is so low, there's a very good chance that you have metabolic syndrome. And that'll probably kill you faster.
It's like 70% of the population
of
has
course.
Metabolic syndrome. Even teenagers, children have it.
You're absolutely right. So we have to find that sweet spot. And we have to find that sweet spot for each individual. Again, I touched on this the other day. We like to develop protocols for the masses. And that's the easiest thing to do. But the truth is, everybody is an individual. The other day I said cancer is a unique disease to every individual, and it's a dynamic disease to each individual. So not only does the treatment need to be individualized, but it needs to be dynamically individualized. And I think you can apply that to what we're talking about right now. So there's a sweet spot for every individual, and it's got to be dynamically managed. I agree with you.
Yeah. So there are 1,000 different threads I'm thinking about pulling from that. But just getting back to GLYNAC, one of the things that you're seeing get more popular is these clinics that do these different cocktails. And one of the things that people will go and do is they get glutathione drips. Do you think an occasional glutathione drip, maybe in response to, a stressor, maybe you drank too much, maybe you've had a stressful week, do you think that's a bad idea?
I do not think it's a bad idea. I think it's a good idea. And as a matter of fact, I want you to know that there's also some data on treating Parkinson's disease. This is a different issue, but treating Parkinson's disease with high-dose glutathione. As a matter of fact, there's a study. I don't know if it's launched yet. If not, they're recruiting. But they're going to be giving patients with Parkinson's glycine and N-acetylcysteine because there's a massive amount of oxidative stress that is going on in the brain with both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. But I think it's absolutely appropriate if someone is has an acute situation, like being hungover from drinking a lot of alcohol, where there's just a ton of oxidative stress, that's a great time to give some glutathione. So I think, you know, getting periodic glutathione drips or injections is very reasonable and helpful.
What about NAD?
So, you know, NAD, and of course, a lot of the work was done by David Sinclair. We know our NAD stores are significantly falling as we age. And the NAD to NADH ratio is definitely going down typically as we age, although there are different ratios for different cancers, which, you know, we don't need to get into at this time. But I think replacing NAD is very important. Now, what is the best way to get it? So there are NAD precursors like nicotinamide mononucleotide and nicotinamide riboside.
Or Niagen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so there are good precursors, and certainly the animal studies show they were helpful in repleting their NAD. And then, of course, there are people that are taking NAD directly through either IV infusions or intramuscular. Now, do I think the concept makes sense? I do. Do we have human studies to demonstrate that it is improving health and lifespan? No, we don't. Now, again, keep in mind that I don't see anybody funding any large randomized studies on NAD because, again, we come back to IP. Where's the intellectual property? Now, on the other hand, if we make a unique molecule that is similar, you know, then I can see someone doing a study. But, you know, is it possible to give too much NAD? Absolutely. Again, we come back down to there's an appropriate amount or sweet spot for everything.
Would you imagine that taking some of these precursors like NMN or NR would have the same sort of dynamic benefit that taking GlyNAC would be for producing glutathione, for
example? Conceptually, yes. It makes sense.
And I know there's a lot of discussion out there on the NMN versus NR. Do you have an opinion on that?
So, you know, some of the studies published show greater bioavailability and NMN is immediately converted. So NR, it requires another step to get converted to NAD. So, I believe David Sinclair prefers mononucleotide, NMN. But have I seen a head-to-head study to show that ultimately it makes a difference in health span and lifespan? We don't have that. We don't know.
So you mentioned your diet. I can remember every day watching you go microwave your little cup of split pea soup.
I don't microwave anymore, by the way.
Do you still eat split pea soup?
Actually, you know, I've gone through, you know, different machinations of what I do. I don't often eat split pea soup. I actually went through a period where my lunch all the time was sautéed broccoli. I got into that for a while. Now I just, you know, I honestly eat, and I'm not telling the public this is the way you must eat. And I think, you know, different people, depending on their situations, need to eat differently. But I eat a little bit of fruit in the morning to get my supplements down. And then about noon, I will have a plant-based protein shake. And then I may have a few cashews later in the day. So I've really consumed, you know, maybe a couple hundred calories during the day. And I feel like I don't need much more. And then I go into my evening meal where I eat most of the time just a plant-based diet, which, you know, typically there are beans in there and different vegetables. And sometimes I add fish in now. And I do that 5 days a week. So if I were to guess, I probably eat 5 days a week, only about 1,100 calories a day.
Wow.
But 2 days a week, you know, Friday and Saturday, I go crazy. And I may eat 1,800, 1,900 calories, maybe even 2,000 calories a day sometimes. And I'm comfortable, you know, where I am now. And I still feel physically very well. I feel like, you know, it's important for the individual to become in tune with their body, to listen to what their body's telling them. For example, I got into trouble several years ago. I started having significant hypoglycemic episodes. My young son is a talented tennis player, and I'd go out on a tennis court with him, and I'd say, buddy, I got to lay down. I'd lay down in the middle of the court. I'm breaking out in a sweat. My heart's starting to race, and I'm like, I need hypoglycemic. I could feel it, and I'd have to start bringing oranges with me. And I realized I was really eating too little. So it's very important to be in tune with your body.
You know, for me personally, just listening to my body, I've ended up in a very different camp. You know, as you know, I've struggled with autoimmune issues for a long time. And when I came to you, and I think we first started talking more regularly than we had in a few years, I think probably 2 or 3 years ago now, I wasn't happy with what I weighed, right? And I had done, you know, there were years that I did a paleo diet. I mean, there's probably a period of 4 or 5 years that I didn't eat a single bite of fast food, you know, and my diet was very limited. And then I was able to liberalize that starting in about 2015, 16 through probably 2019. But I got to the point where I was not happy with my appearance or just how I felt. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to do the keto diet, which I am not against, by the way. I think we generally consume way too many carbs. But what I found was that my performance suffered. I felt like, you know, they say that, you know, over time you get fat adapted to where you're more efficient at running off ketones and you're able to think more clearly. And there's absolutely something to that for me. I do think I was thinking pretty clearly, but I still wasn't very functional because I just felt stressed and my energy wasn't there. And the thing that I figured out for me, and it's so simple, right? So many of the foods that we eat and are made now, they're almost an attempt to hack our biology. You know, we crave fat, sugars, salt. And if you have those things, these foods become hyper palatable. And so we tend to overeat. And what I figured out is that if I just consume enough protein specifically, I actually eat probably close to a gram of protein per pound of body weight that I would like to weigh. And when I do that, I find that my ability to trust my level of satiety is calibrated much better. And I don't overeat, you know, some of these other hyperpalatable foods. It's much easier for me to eat a reasonable amount of carbohydrates and a reasonable amount of fat when I take in enough protein. It's just simple as that.
Makes perfect sense.
And you've watched the impact on how I've transformed in the last couple of years. You know, you've watched it, and I just can't emphasize enough. It's not stressful. It's not difficult. I enjoy it. I like steak. You know, and it has just worked for me personally. So yeah, and I'm not saying categorically that this is the right thing, but I think it's, you know, it's different than what you do, but I do think it's the right thing for me.
Sure, and honestly, I mean, what you at the physiologic level, you know, I'll touch on why it should really work for everybody. You know, I mentioned the other day that, you know, I was working on making CCK or cholecystokinin bioavailable. And so when you eat protein and fat, but even at just consuming larger amounts of protein, you're going to release more CCK or cholecystokinin, which will then, you know, tell your brain, the satiety center in your brain, that I've had enough. In addition, as you know, when you're consuming more protein as opposed to simple carbohydrates, you're not going to get as big an insulin response. You know, when you eat pure carbohydrates, you know, the old saying, you know, go to a Chinese restaurant and you're hungry an hour later. Well, you know, if you're eating a lot of white rice, you get a really large insulin response. And some of these people will come out of the meals shortly after the meal, their blood sugar is lower than when they started, and they need more. So it's certainly, if we just look at the insulin response and cholecystokinin, eating the way you're eating makes sense if you increase your protein. And as a matter of fact, from a muscle standpoint, the literature shows that as you increase your protein intake up to a maximum of 2 grams per kilo, you continue to be able to build more muscle mass. Now, you know, the literature shows that when you go past 2 grams per kilo, you don't get any more out of it. You basically start undergoing gluconeogenesis, meaning you'll be converting a lot of the protein into carbohydrates. But certainly what you're saying makes complete sense.
And another thing too, I'm reminded of something that my wife has really gotten into. And I'll tell you, my wife is actually, she's more fit now at her age than she was when we were both 20. And something that she's really focused on that's worked for her is actually the order. If she sits down for a meal, the order of what she eats. If you eat, as my understanding, if you eat your fats first, your fiber first, your protein, and then you consume your carbs last, then what you'll see is your digestion is slowed by those other things, and you get less of an insulin spike from eating the exact same things.
You're correct, yeah.
So, and actually, you know, talking about meat consumption, going back to glycine, you know, another hallmark of aging is how our endogenous collagen production declines as we age, right? Most people think of collagen as this thing that is just found in our skin, and if we consume enough collagen, then, you know, it'll keep our skin youthful looking. But it's also true, and I think more importantly, collagen is the scaffolding for every tissue in our body. And not only do we have less of it in our skin, but we produce less of it as we age. And as you know, the most abundant amino acid in collagen specifically is glycine. So I think there is, you know, you're talking about how our bodies are dynamic. And there's a benefit for our bodies to be able to choose how much glutathione it wants to synthesize. I think when it's not being converted to glutathione, there's another huge benefit, which is it's being used to repair and restore our tissues.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if you consider, you know, our diet now, the muscle meat that we eat tends to be, it tends to be leaner. You know, people think of filet mignon as the preferable steak because it's lean and tender. People who are dining and trying to eat healthy, they're eating boneless, skinless chicken breast, right? And historically, this is not the way we ate. We ate all parts of the buffalo, right? And so I really think we've done ourselves a disservice by skipping, you know, this connective tissue and these organ meats that are more nutrient dense. And I really question all of the conversation, all of the data around meat consumption and a negative impact on longevity, because I just don't believe that we eat meat in this environment the way that we used to. I don't think we eat the same meat that's consistent with our DNA and the way we're designed to eat meat. And not to mention the quality of the meat that we eat. You know, we're eating steaks from cows that grew up eating genetically modified corn, and that corn was genetically modified so it can be layered and layered with glyphosate, right?
And not to mention that they're injected with recombinant growth hormone.
Right, right. So I just don't know. We've gotten to this point where our conversations around diet are so political to the point of tribal. And it's like you can almost guess how, you know, you can guess someone's political identity based on how they choose to eat. And that's just not science. And frankly, it's ridiculous, right? We should be able to have open conversations with nuance about these things.
And we really, we need to be able to sit back and analyze data. And you and I, you know, before we started this podcast, you know, we had talked about the fact that, you know, what really is the best way to eat? Do we really have data? And the problem is most, if you look at most of the studies on diet, whether you're talking about diet and overall mortality, you know, lifespan, cancer. Most of the data is retrospective. And the other problem when you look at the studies on red meat intake, and some of my patients have said to me, red meat intake, they've showed it increases the risk for colorectal cancer, prostate, breast cancer. But how many of those patients got, you know, grass-fed beef that weren't injected with anything and weren't eating the garbage? Well, I don't know.
And red meat is something that takes a lot of work for our digestive system to digest, right? How many of those patients who are eating a lot of red meat in these studies that end up with colorectal cancer are on chronic PPIs?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So the problem, and you bring up the point that these retrospective studies really don't tell us a lot. We don't. We infer what we want to infer from that. Now, of course, we could figure this out. So, for example, if we take the people in the blue zone and we take Japanese district of Okinawa, we take those people that are living the way they're living, and we divide those groups into two, and one group, we make them only eat plant-based, and the other group is eating whatever amount of meat protein we decide we want to put them on. Do a prospective randomized study like that, then we'll be able to really glean something and say, aha, okay. So, we significantly increased our percentage of centenarians by stopping those individuals in Okinawa from eating meat, or the reverse. But unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have these answers because there's just no financial incentive to fund prospective expensive studies on diet.
And look, I have my opinions, and I have the way that I tend to behave and live. And because this is such a personal thing that people's identities are sort of wrapped up in, if someone tells me they eat a certain way, the last thing that I'm ever going to do is say, you shouldn't be eating this way, and here's why, right? But because in part, I think it's the decent thing to do, but also, and it's also not effective, right? It just divides people, right? But to your point, it's so hard to tease these things out and have complete control over these things. I just really, 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 really believe we need to make an effort to divorce this from political ideology. It's because we don't know the answers to these things, and we're deluding ourselves if we think that we do, and putting ourselves in certain camps as a consequence of that.
I agree.
We were talking about the way we're socialized yesterday. I think this is true. This is an example of that, right? So we can get back to that, but I want to, first and foremost, I want to touch on some of these other human performance, anti-aging conversations. Some things that are popular parts of the discussion right now are, for example, cold plunges. My wife and I have one, and we use it, and we love it. And I do notice when I spend a few minutes in a cold plunge where the water is under 59 degrees, I do see, enhanced energy, enhanced mood, enhanced focus. And halfway in, I usually just sort of get this goofy grin on my face because of the elevated dopamine that it seems to me like you get from it. But I'll be honest with you, it's just fun to me. I don't know what the literature says. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, so the thing is, we don't have any long-term data. It's very interesting. You and I actually just, for a moment before the podcast, we talked about hormesis. The concept of hormesis is giving a potentially toxic or harmful substance, I should say, to the body in small amounts, but getting benefits. Doing a cold plunge, extreme cryotherapy is a real stress. It's a real stress on the body that causes a great compensatory response. So I will tell you, some of the short-term data looks promising. But so here's the big question. So should we do cold plunges? Should we do it regularly? And if we do it regularly, or whatever the regimen is, because I don't know what would be the optimal regimen, Will it increase health span and lifespan in the long term? I don't know, and I don't know that we're ever, again, I don't know that we're ever going to have that data. Do I think it's, you know, if people in the short term feel good, I think it's reasonable to do it. But for so many of these modalities, again, I don't know that we're ever going to get to the bottom of it to, you know, because we'll need a, of course, a randomized prospective study.
Now, do you think on specifically, so correct me if I'm wrong, but there, I believe there was a long-term study where they followed these men in Finland for decades who used sauna. And I think the, like the baseline criteria for that was, I could be getting this wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but 20 minutes, three times a week above 165 degrees. Is that,
you know, I honestly don't remember the temperature,
but I believe,
but
that,
it was sauna. You're absolutely,
I believe
right.
that they, in this group, they saw a 40% reduction in all cause mortality between treatment and control groups.
Yes, you're right. You're right.
So that, to me, that's pretty incredible. And I wonder if that is, you know, you just talk about this hormetic effect generally, but you know, we do know with sauna use that it does elevate levels of HGH endogenously, and it does produce heat shock proteins.
Sure.
But I'll tell you, I'm not really clear on what the benefits of heat shock proteins are.
Well,
so so what I'm driving at is there an analog there between the hormetic effect of sauna use or versus cold plunge?
And so they used a, you know, unique saunas. The other question is if different saunas were used, or if the same study was done in a different environment.
I believe they were these old school traditional dry saunas, not the infrared saunas.
You're absolutely right. And that, so what I did after reading that study is I tried to find more literature comparing the two. And we don't have that answer. So I don't know. But I also wonder, you know, are these people in Finland, is there something unique about them from where they are? Are their genetics unique? And if we did the exact same study in San Antonio, Texas, would we get different results? So, you know, we all want to, you know, we want to read a study and we want to take it for granted and say it applies to everybody. I don't know.
Just pure conjecture on that. It's my understanding that sauna use in Finland is more of a broad traditional cultural thing as opposed to something like healthy user bias.
Sure.
It's something just people just generally do there.
Sure.
I tend to trust it and I like using sauna, right? Especially during the wintertime. Okay, so moving on. So what about HIIT training, for example?
So high-intensity interval training is very, very interesting. And I try to incorporate it into my exercise. Now, one of the things, I'm just going to, you know, touch on cancer a little bit. And I think I had mentioned it the other day that one of the great obstacles to living long is cancer, you know, and the incidence of cancer, especially in our younger population, is greatly increasing. And so there was an interesting study out of Israel, and the first part of this was a retrospective study. And what they did is they interviewed, I don't remember, I think it was around 10,000 individuals, I don't remember the exact number. But what they did is they asked individuals who did cardiovascular exercise nearly daily for the past decade versus those who didn't. And there was 72% less metastatic cancer in the group that did regular cardiovascular exercise. Now, again, you can pin holes in this and say, okay, it's a retrospective study. So let me ask you, what else was different? You know, how do you know that, you know, the people who didn't do exercise, that they weren't sneaking, you know, a lot of smoking in?
Healthy user bias.
Yeah, of course. We don't know. But because that number, 72%, that's pretty darn impressive. So they went a step further. And what they did is they injected cancer into two groups of mice. And, you know, the natural history is if you inject enough cancer, it's going to metastasize or spread to other parts of the body. But then here's what they did. They took one group of mice and they made them get on an exercise wheel at a certain speed for a certain number of hours every single day. And the other group did not get the benefit of exercise. And at the end of the study, 75% of the group that were exercising, it didn't metastasize. The cancer didn't go anywhere.
Wow.
Whereas 100% of the other group did. And they in the study, they talked about the importance of there was always a period of high intensity interval training where they made those mice really work very, very hard. Then they went a step further and they said, okay, so we showed that exercising and exercising hard stopped cancer from spreading. And so they wanted to understand, you know, what was the physiology behind that? So then they biopsied the organs. And this was something that was fascinating. And I'm going to now kind of segue into sugar or glucose. So when you're exercising hard, your muscles are directly taking up a lot of glucose. And what they found in these animals was interesting. Because they were exercising hard and they were exercising daily, all the muscles were taking up the glucose and the other organs had to compensate so they can get adequate glucose, right? I mean, glycolysis is occurring everywhere. So what their other normal organs did is they overexpressed their own GLUT1 transporters to bring in more glucose. And the net effect was, to quote what they said in the study, it was like their entire body, all their organs, became one big muscle sucking up glucose. So now you introduce cancer, there's just not enough food left for the cancer. It was very interesting. So this was a very, very powerful study for me. And it certainly, I came away with this saying, you know, exercise is so, so important. I know we talk about diet, and of course diet's important, but it is even possible. And I'm not telling people you can eat like crap and you can get away with it as long as you exercise hard. But is it possible that the importance of exercise even trumps diet? I don't know. I don't want to go that far. But I do want to say exercise is super important. And I do think that, again, almost, you know, alluding to hormesis a little bit, a short interval of high intensity is super important. And what I do, I don't have the time to go to the gym every day, but I do have an elliptical in my house. And I will do 20 minutes a day on the elliptical. And that last 5 minutes, I am killing it. I mean, I'm 63 years old. I'll get my heart rate into the 180s for 5 minutes. And I think that's important to do.
So this is sort of an interesting intersection for you in particular, because your interest, I know, is specifically in both anti-aging and the origins and treatment of cancer, right? And it sort of touches back on something we were talking about earlier when I mentioned all these different diseases that are metabolic diseases, possibly. And the obvious one that I failed to mention was cancer. So, you know, traditionally, it seems like, or historically, we thought about cancer as originating with a degradation in our DNA. So we're giving our body the wrong set of instructions, and that ends up looking like cancer. And this is an inflammatory condition, right? So, and if you look at, you know, the behaviors that people engage in, the tissues that they are repeatedly, you know, subject to toxic chemicals and are chronically inflamed, this is where people end up usually getting cancer. And it's also, you know, chronic radiation exposure example, and it's, for example, and its impact on DNA and how that leads to cancer. How do you square that? You know, if I smoke for a long time, there's a good chance I'll get cancer in my lungs, right? But at the same time, what you're saying of the impact on HIIT training and cancer, it's like, I never know whether to believe cancer is a metabolic disease or just a product of chronic inflammation or what the intersection of that is.
My take is it's everything. So, you know, we're looking for what is the source for cancer. And, you know, if I had a dollar for every patient that came to me, and I'm not kidding when I tell you I get this every week. I have patients that come to me and say, I want to know what caused my cancer so I could get rid of it.
Right.
And then they assume they'll get rid of their cancer.
Right.
The problem is, you know, you said, is it a metabolic disease? Is it a disease of overwhelming oxidative stress? Is it a disease of chronic inflammation? The answer is all of the above. But one of the important take-home points here is, you know, why are blue zones different? Well, I will tell you, in much of the developed world, the number of toxins that we're exposed to daily is not hundreds, not thousands, but it's millions and maybe it's billions. And so all the things you talked about, you know, chronic inflammation, overwhelming oxidative stress, metabolic disease, it's all of the above. And I think it becomes very difficult when someone says, you know, what caused my cancer? Well, let me see. If you're exposed to billions of toxins a day, I don't know. As a matter of fact, I don't know how many people in the audience recently read that the EPA approved a substance that Chevron is using in their fuel for boats. So this this was reported in the news probably about, I don't know, 4 to 8 weeks ago. And so this substance is obtained from recycled plastics. And one of the former EPA scientists studied that the substance that was approved. And to quote this scientist, this is the most carcinogenic substance she has ever studied in her life. Some people questioned the EPA, and of course, they declined to answer. Although one of the scientists said, well, we think that the danger of this substance was a little bit exaggerated. But having said that, the scientist, and there were actually two scientists, former EPA scientists that looked at this, they were very clear that this was the most, by far, the most carcinogenic substance they've ever studied. And it was approximately 20 times more carcinogenic than smoking cigarettes daily is to lung cancer. And so this is just one of the substances that has come to light. But, you know, I want the public to understand that we do the best we can. And we do the best we can by eating as best we can, by exercising as best we can, by being in the best, you know, in social networks as we can, and de-stressing. But we are still exposed to what we're exposed to. How many patients have I seen in my career that are young and doing what we think is right, you know, that healthy lifestyle, and they get cancer, and they get what we're now calling is turbo cancers. Where are these young people getting turbo cancers that are just, it's blowing apart our paradigm? You know, we talk about how many years it takes for cancer to develop, and we're seeing, you know, these cancers are rising de novo, and they're flying. I mean, they're growing so rapidly. And again, I think, you know, our environment, the exposure to toxins is, it's becoming cumulative. So, you know, let's reverse back to, you know, we'll say 200 years ago. We had toxins back then, but we didn't have nearly as many as we do now. And I think what's happening is we're having more and more toxins, and there's a cumulative effect. And I don't see the incidence of disease in general going down with time. Despite the fact that we have all these technological developments to treat disease better, I think the incidence of disease, including cancer, is just going to continue to escalate.
And now I'd add to that a question that I have is not just a cumulative effect, but what combinations of these toxins that we're exposed to have a synergistic effect?
Very good question.
You know, these things are, you know, the EPA allowable limits to these things are usually examined in a vacuum, right? It's like, how much of this specific thing can be tolerated? But it's like, how much of this specific thing can be tolerated in the presence of this other thing, this other thing, this other thing, and what's the interaction? And we do not know.
Excellent point. That's an excellent point. Yeah, it's And again, you know, it's kind of impossible to study because, you know, if we're dealing with millions of toxins, good luck trying to do a study to look at synergy. But you're absolutely right. And synergy, I think, is, you know, plays a very, very important role. And thank you for bringing that up. Absolutely.
So, you know, you're talking about this substance that's used in, you said, boat fuel?
Yes, correct. Boat fuel.
I missed what it was.
So, you know, I don't know what they call the substance. Okay. I only know that it was derived from recycled plastic. Okay.
And what use was it approved for?
You mean it's boat fuel, but specifically what use?
So it was approved for boat fuel?
For boat fuel.
Okay, I thought you were saying it was already used as boat fuel and it was maybe approved for food or something.
No. It is approved, but the problem with this, it is now approved to be put in boat fuel. And the problem is that this is released in the waters that is feeding our fish that we're eating. And, of course, it's also getting in the air.
Do you know anything about the impact of some of these other things in the water that people talk about? Atrazine, fluoride, triclosan. Are these things overblown, you think? Or
you know what? I'm not well enough educated in that to answer. I have to be honest.
Okay. All right. And then the other thing that seems to be a hot topic right now is the impact of plastics as endocrine disruptors.
Sure.
You have anything to say about that?
Well, so now, you know, I didn't know this until recently. I'm sure you've read the articles coming out that really, you know, certainly every human in this country has microplastics floating around in their bloodstream. And large amounts of microplastics. And I think, you know, yes, there's evidence of them being endocrine disruptors, but what else are they doing beyond disrupting the endocrine system? Could they be carcinogenic? Could they be stimulating autoimmune disease? Well, it certainly makes sense that it would. So I think that hopefully there'll be a lot more research, but I do believe that microplastics are going to be, we'll eventually find out, they're huge problems in causing disease.
Well, I'm happy to dig into this anti-aging stuff further with you because I know that this is what you're specializing in. But, you know, yesterday I spoke briefly and generally about how you've helped me over the last 2 or 3 years. And I want people to know what I'm talking about and how you've helped me. And I went on a short little rant about how theories of disease are written in response to the drugs that have a therapeutic impact on a certain set of symptoms. So in 2021, since I was 21 years old, I have had really horrible chronic acid reflux. And people hear me say that and they say, well, I have heartburn too. Everybody has heartburn. And it's like, no, I have regular heartburn and regular reflux regardless of if I'm just drinking water. Okay. And in 2022, I actually had an EGD where they found a benign tumor on my esophagus from this chronic irritation. And that was enough that it was a wake-up call for me. But I can tell you that it got much worse in 2020 and 2021. And I see a gastroenterologist who is has been someone that I've known since I was a child. He went to high school with my brother, and he's a great guy, and I consider him a friend. But he theorized, well, he guessed that maybe the reason why huge doses of PPIs in H2 drugs were not adequately addressing my symptoms was that maybe I had gastroparesis. So first of all, I have questions about this idea of gastroparesis in general, because when we do a gastric emptying test, it's only a snapshot of how the stomach is functioning at any given time. And if, for example, you're extremely constipated the day that you do that, you're going to have a lot of gastric pressure probably, and your stomach's going to empty very slowly. But, you know, the conversation is binary. Is it, does your stomach empty well or doesn't it?
Sure.
Right? But in this case, you know, I had had one years ago, and you know, the food that they had given me is supposed to sit in your stomach for 4 hours. It lasted 20 minutes in my stomach, and it was gone. And so he kind of said, you know, this result is ridiculous, and I just don't believe this, but I know what your symptoms are. So I'm going to give you a drug that may help, and if it helps, we'll consider that diagnostic. And the drug was metoclopramide, or the trade name Reglan. And this is a drug that's commonly used. It's gradually becoming less commonly used, but a few years ago, it was very commonly used. And it's used to treat women who are having trouble lactating after giving birth. It's given as a part of a headache cocktail for people who have migraines. And it's given in emergency rooms frequently to people who just simply have nausea. But it's also a class of drugs that, in a class of drugs that are considered prokinetics. It was actually first developed as an antipsychotic drug. It was a poor antipsychotic drug, but they figured out that it had a prokinetic effect, and that was a much more prevalent effect. So what I mean by prokinetic is that it stimulates muscle contractions. It encourages faster motility throughout the digestive tract, right? So, and the way that it does that, the way we're told that it does that is there's a specific dopamine receptor that is inhibitory. And if you block that dopamine receptor, these muscle contractions, go ahead. So anyway, this drug, it has a black box warning for a specific condition called tardive dyskinesia, which is a sort of disfiguring, it presents to people who have seen it as an extreme version of Tourette's. And this is the only thing that I was warned against whenever I was given this drug. And I took it orally. Some people take 15 milligrams a day. I was taking 5 milligrams a day of this drug. And I can remember one night, it was like a bomb went off in my brain, Dr. Rosenberg. I woke up in the middle of the night. I was running around the house. I could not physically sit still. I couldn't make myself sit still. And over the course of the next few days, I developed this feeling that my entire body was being electrocuted 17, 18 hours a day. And when I say electrocuted, that's not a loose example to try to explain it. I grew up in a farm around electric fences, and I ran into them many times, and it felt exactly like I was being electrocuted. This, what the impact of this drug was on my nervous system, it created an electrical problem in my nervous system and in my brain. In addition, I developed Parkinsonism, to where I had real trouble with fine motor movements. I'm a musician, as you know. I couldn't play guitar. Tasks like prepping medicine and using a fork and knife at times became very difficult for me, where I had sort of a fine tremor. Beyond that, I had this horrible anxiety, this feeling of anxiety that wasn't based on any particular thought. It wasn't like I was on an airplane. It was like, I'm afraid of it falling. It was just, I'm anxious because I'm breathing. I'm anxious because I'm awake. I couldn't drive a car. I couldn't be by myself. I couldn't go out in public because of this anxiety. And I remember I got to the point where I thought, maybe I can start to go out in public. I went into Costco. I got two aisles into the store, and I had to leave my grocery cart and sprint out of the store because I was claustrophobic inside a warehouse. And I also had what I can only describe as depressive attacks. And when I say depressive attacks, people think of the intensity of a panic attack, where you're driving down the road, you have a panic attack, you think you're having a heart attack, you pull over because you think you might die, and you go to the emergency room, right? I had the equivalent of that with depression. It was a level of darkness and despondency that I didn't know was possible for a human being to feel. Wow. And when I say that, it's hard for me to say this, but I should say it. I have never had been a person who's had any inclination whatsoever towards self-harm. And there are times I would be sitting on the couch and I would have thought, I'm going to make this stop, except it's not even worth it. Why bother? And so I got no help from general doctors. I got no help from neurologists. They all just said, this drug can cause tardive dyskinesia. That's the only warning. And it seems to me like you just have some anxiety and some depression. It was like, funny, I've never had it before I had this drug. And I found a community of people, of thousands of people, who are all experiencing the same long-term effects that I was from this drug. I know women who have had to, who have gotten divorced, who have given up their children. I believe there's one girl that I spoke to that did eventually end up ending her life. And I know people who are years out from receiving this drug, and they received an IV push of it one time, and these people are never the same again. And so, I started to dig into the literature on this, and it does have an impact on 5-HT4 serotonin receptors. It has an impact on dopamine 2 as well as dopamine 3 receptors. It has an impact on NMDA receptors. There actually was an animal study which just sort of coincidentally involved metoclopramide, where they had the control group, which was not chronically treated with metoclopramide, and then they had the study group, or the treatment group, that was chronically treated with metoclopramide. And then after a period of this treatment, they gave these rats Halidol. The rats that had been treated over course of time with metoclopramide all went catatonic whenever they were given Halidol, and stayed that way, and the other ones didn't. And when they autopsied these rats, what they found is that the metoclopramide group expressed much higher density of glutamate receptors in the brains than the other group did. And as you know, there's the seesaw of balance between GABA and glutamate. Glutamate is the most powerful and abundant excitatory hormone, and GABA is the one that calms the brain down. And so I really think, what this causes is something like a constant low-grade seizure, if that makes any sense. And there's also evidence in the literature that it causes serotonin syndrome, which, as you know, can be life-threatening. And there's no warning label on this drug that it shouldn't be given in combination with SSRIs. I wasn't given SSRIs, but there's a lot of stories of patients who are on SSRIs who have a catastrophic, life-changing, life-ruining effect from being given this drug. So for me, the way that you help me is you simply listened to me and trusted me whenever I was describing this to you. And when I came to you with some of this literature and I said, this is what's going on, this is what the science of it seems like to me, can we try this, just to give me a lifeline to try to fight back. And you cooperated with me and helped me, and really the first big step that I was able to make toward my recovery of getting my life back was when you were willing to treat me with propranolol, because we know that one of the symptoms of metoclopramide is akathisia, and no one else would identify that. But once I was able to calm my body down through propranolol, I was able to start doing the work of trying to heal my mind. And the way that I did that was through diet and through frequent cardio, like distance running, training for marathons. Sure. And that's the thing that helped me get my sanity back and helped me keep it. And I apologize, I know you have to go, but I could spend, another 30 minutes outlaying what happened to me and how I want to warn against it and how you've helped. But we will have to pick that up another day. Thank you for just being there for me again. I know I told you that yesterday. And thank you for doing this.
Of course, that I would always be there. Yeah. I will always be there. Thank you.